matter of just establishing our right to take it back.
I wouldn't recommend it only for that purpose. No. I would recommend it, you know, if you could make a sale of that type that had advantages for the state. But I didn't recommend it last year, and I wouldn't recommend it now necessarily only for that purpose. Fred makes a point that I think sort of bears out what I just said. It would be one of the problems is that, again, you go back to the fact that what the FPC regulates is the transportation, so that if you made a big sale like this based on the Moody theory, which we didn't agree with particularly last year, every transportation arrangement that grows out of that contract would have to be approved. And it may not be that every one of them would be decided uniformly, so that you just have to, I guess, face the fact that you're swimming in fairly uncertain waters on a great deal of this. But I would not necessarily recommend, in fact, I wouldn't recommend a sale of this magnitude only for that purpose.
Representative Chatterton.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make a statement and somebody around here tell me if I'm halfway right. By virtue of the state of Alaska entering into these contracts, we have then, and they're all signed, everything's happy for a year from today. These contracts are in force. All right, we have then taken our 1/8 gas in kind. We have opted to do that instead of taking it in value. Therefore, I see no similarity between our situation a year from today. These having been signed, and your North Carolina case, is that a factual statement?
The North Carolina case deals with the question of whether Texas, as a state and the owner of royalty gas, must get approval of the FTC to make the sale. The Federal Power Commission, every time the owner of gas wishes to sell that gas in interstate commerce or resale, in other words, if he's selling it to an interstate pipeline, which is going to sell it to somebody else at the other end, and in turn is going to sell it to somebody else, and that's the way the whole business operates. The main pipeline sells to this distribution company that sells to people and consume it. So every time you make a sale like that, you have to go to the Federal Power Commission to get approval of that sale. The way the definitions are set up in the Natural Gas Act, it appears states do not have to do that. They can sell gas without getting Federal Power Commission approval. That is what the issue in the Texas case. If Texas wins, there will be no question but that this contract is sale. This contract does not have to be approved insofar as the state making a sale of the gas is concerned. If we lose that, this contract must be approved. If Texas loses that, and we are unable to distinguish ourselves from Texas, and there are some grounds for doing so, if Texas loses and we end up in the same bag, then this contract will have to be submitted to the Federal Power Commission for approval.
Mr. Chairman, if I might continue.
Please continue.
Keep in mind, I'm just a poor old dumb country boy, and I got to take this a little slow. All right. We are contracted. I hear what you just told me. We are in the process to sign a contract to sell 1/8 of the natural gas existing in the Prudhoe Bay oil pool. There is no contract that I know of for the sale of the remaining 7/8 yet. And your concern is that, I'm hearing you right, that lose this North Carolina case, why it's going to be a matter that the 1/8 tail of does not wag the 7/8 of the dog. Is that it? As far as the FPC is concerned?
Okay, I think when you jump from the 7/8 to 1/8, I think you may be confusing the Pacific Alaska case. Which
I don't even know about it, so I can't confuse.
Okay.
Maybe.
I can't be confused there.
Okay. Let me come at it this way. What happened in Texas was Texas leased the land and they discovered gas. oil company sold all the gas to somebody, to somebody in the...
Yes, the landowner chose, if I can help along here, so my understanding is, and so we get across, the landowner there chose to take his royalty share of gas in value, didn't he? All right? Okay. He already exercised his election, if it's least read that way, to take it in value. Now, I can readily see where he gave up his option there at that point in time. I can readily see that we have elected our option to take in kind before the first cubic inch of gas is moved. Is that right?
Okay, I see. And okay, but the answer is, the problem from the point of view of the FTC is every sale. It doesn't matter whether you make it on the first day that gas is produced or you wait 2 or 3 years and then take the royalty in kind. Every sale in interstate commerce for resale must be approved by the FTC. There's one exception to that which we believe exists, and that is states do not have to have their sales approved. That's what's being argued in Texas, and that's what we're arguing here.
Yeah,
sorry,
I think
to belabor the point.
Okay, Charlie, I want to mention one thing, that if we have any questions, the Commissioner Martin, I didn't want to keep him here too late. He has another commitment. He was gracious enough to come, and not even with the conflict. So
he enjoyed our company.
I know. We'll get him back again, too.
Right.
Charlie?
My question, I thought I heard Mr. Martin on Mr. Ness say a while ago something that may make this whole thing about Texas academic, and that was, I believe you said that even if the case, the court could hold, or somebody holds it, they don't require FTC approval. The state doesn't. The FTC still controls all the transportation mechanisms, so unless they were keeping it within Texas, that wouldn't make much difference anyway. Is that correct? So and how, if that is transferable to our case, if we're not distinguishable, right, then even if we got the right, okay, they don't control our sale, but we still could ship anywhere without FTC approval. We have to use it all in the state.
Right.
So it's kind of an academic thing.
That's the follow-on statement to Representative Chatterton's statement.
Could I ask one more question, Mr. Chairman?
Please, Representative Parr.
FTC controls all the shipments in interstate commerce. That's why they have a stranglehold on us, even if they couldn't control the sale, they could control the shipment. And do they also control all the shipments that go outside the country without going to another state? Suppose we decide to put the stuff in, we liquefy it, and we sell it to Japan or wherever. Do they have that stranglehold too?
Yes, they do, and there are two reasons for that. One is you cannot export gas from the United States without approval of the FTC and the license. And the second is, even though the pipeline would be located all within Alaska, they would still control that transportation. So even if they didn't have to, you didn't have to get an export certificate, they could prevent you from moving it from Prudhoe Bay to...
I mean, they would control an intrastate pipeline, and they would also, and they would have to give you the export license. So what, is that what you're saying?
I'm concerned by your use of the word intrastate pipeline.
Pipeline began in Alaska, ends in Alaska, intrastate.
But that isn't the way the statute reads. The statute says somebody transporting gas in interstate commerce. So even though the pipeline is all located in Alaska, because the gas ends up in the lower 48, that pipeline was transported gas.
I said but they cover that by the export line.
Well, but if anybody's gas goes to the lower 48, then they get control of the pipeline.
Well, my last point, Mr. Chairman, is to make sure I had this clear. The point is, unless we used all that gas in the state of Alaska, right, then the Texas case, even just one, doesn't really mean too much to us. We could have the authority if the Texas case is wanted.
Charlie,
could sell it to anybody we wanted to, but we couldn't
say anything. Let me just say this. I don't think you can say that it doesn't mean anything to us, but it doesn't solve all our problems. It would be bad to lose it. It would be better to win it, but it certainly doesn't solve all our problems. There's other hurdles to be cleared even if we win it.
Representative Hayes?
Recognizing that Commissioner Martin has to leave, I just want to make a comment that there are some questions that I wanted to ask that are not related to what we're talking about now, so I will defer to a later opportunity. But
I intend to go on unless there are more questions in this area on the FTC.
I just want to ask you one question regarding what we've been discussing so far. Just a little bit of background since you were in the last legislature, right? And some of the other people there also. Apparently, there was legislation passed prior to now that essentially directed the governor to enter into or to pursue selling our oil to gas. Was the thinking behind that legislation essentially what we're talking about right now, to try to preserve the right? What was the motive in asking the governor to pursue this, to confirm our ability to sell it, or were there other motives? And I'm getting a feeling, you know, so far up to this point, you get the feeling that the only reason we have a contract with Boris is because we are trying to preserve the integrity of our right to sell our oil to gas. Is that a true statement? And is that what this was all about before?
I can't speak for the 60, you know, the other 59
well,
members.
There was
an appropriation of $50,000 made to the Department of Natural Resources to negotiate a contract. But no, in my opinion, that appropriation was not made for the sole purpose of entering a contract so we could secure before the FPC a right to take that. No. But I think there were a lot of motives for people voting for it, and maybe it's appropriate now if we have questions of Commissioner Martin to ask him. What was your understanding of what you're supposed to do with that $50,000?
It's one of those provisions, and it's really one of the reasons I reacted very strongly to statements that where each individual legislator or administration official attempts to say what the motive was. It was a mix of motives. No question in my mind that many of the legislators believe that we should undertake these contracts specifically to support the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Others believe that the Moody theory was a theory worth pursuing. Others, I think, believe that we should move forward and just simply take our gas in line and see what we can do with it. I think it was a mix, and what everyone has now is the freedom to deny whatever motive they may have felt or expressed at the time. But I personally think that it's undeniable that there was a very strong strong direction established to, number one, negotiate, and number two, seek support for the gas line, and number three, see what we could do to carry out the Moody theory. The fact that Section 13B came along is basically an added plus, which we're able to take advantage of possibly by this contract. I think that misses the point of this whole debate, though, actually,
yeah.
And it's one that we tried to avoid very early in the governor's statement and my own, and simply get on with the business of trying to figure out whether these contracts make any sense to us.
I'd agree with you there. Representative Meekins?
Mr. Chairman, I just have one question. The language in 13B, doesn't that, you know, assuming that everything works right and we prevail, our interests are prevalent in the Texas cases, say that's not sufficient because we still have to get authorization for the shipment of gas interstate commerce. But doesn't this language mandate that they allow us to do that? I mean, in 13B isn't exactly what it is.
Sure.
So that, I mean, if we're over that hurdle of the sale and 13B is not repealed, all these ifs, but then we are, it is sort of sufficient.
You,
in order
that's
to,
right. If you,
for this contract.
If you assume 13B is there forever,
right.
Then we have the luxury to assume it's there for a while, then this contract may take
and
advantage.
And the FPC can't say anything about the sale because of Texas or other reasons.
That's right. 13B,
then that's enough.
We agree with the chairman. It's about as clear as you can write a provision.
Any other questions? Representative McKinnon?
When we're talking about the repeal of 13B, just ran across my mind. I was wondering what percentage, assuming the contracts are approved, what portion of these companies' reserves will our oil and gas represent?
1/8.
No, I realize that. It'll be 1/8 of the gas coming out of crude oil. But what portion of the reserves that these companies have? Nationwide, will our gas represent?
I can't give you those figures off the top of my head, but we can supply them to the committee.
I was just, the point I was thinking about was, considering if they do represent a substantial portion of their reserves, how reasonable 1- and 2-year notice provisions are going to be seen by
Chicago.
Without 13 years with it.
Well,
I do understand your question. Clearly, you could make the attempt to essentially take advantage of the terms of 13B as, you know, more reasonable and more reasonable. for instance, the most reasonable way to make it would be to lengthen out the notice provision to a great length, 5 or 6 years, and then allow the state take-back privileges only for certain specified priority uses omitted by heavy industrialization and so on in Alaska. And no question in my mind that would make it more attractive.
Yeah, but by reserves, I think you're referring to, Joe, the amount of gas they had committed under sales or commitment to sell.
Yeah. Chairman, clarification. Joe, are you thinking of the companies that own the 7/8 of gas?
No. You're asking, for instance, if Southern Natural Gas buys a quarter of our gas, how does that compare with what they have? I mean, is that half of their gas or more? The answer in broad terms is with a company like Southern Natural Gas, it represents a very substantial amount of their reserves, not half by any means. But in the case of both Tenneco and El Paso, it represents a much smaller percentage. Incidentally, I might just say that I don't know if anyone's here familiar with the advanced gas contracting procedures, but it was a way that people bought gas during the past few years until it was finally outlawed at the federal level. But what it did is it took to the ultimate extreme the ripping off of gas companies by gas owners by making them pay in a huge cash sums in advance of the time they got any gas, and in some extreme cases they paid in advance for gas that wasn't even produced yet, and they didn't get their money back if they didn't hit gas. That's how bad it got before they struck the contracts down. So compared to some of the arrangements that have been affecting the United States over the past years, ours is not exactly the model of reasonableness, but it is a very reasonable in comparison to some of the buying.
Has that FPC decision on, I think it was FPC decision said no advance payments?
It was a federal court decision which then mandated the FPC to not allow anyone to
Does that have any relation on the state's ability to get, say, bonus payments for gas sales in the future?
That precludes it at the present time.
Absolutely. There's no way.
Well, it not absolutely, but it precludes advanced contracts, which would be the most likely way to get it.
What it actually precludes is the company putting it in the rate base.
I understand that, but does that, as a practical matter, preclude cash bonuses? I mean, generally, you'd think if you sell something now, commit it now as opposed to the future, even though you're getting what the price is in the future, that usually in other commodities is worth something. But you're saying in the gas business now that isn't?
It would be worth something, but it would be unlikely that in the event that they can't pass it through that it would be very substantial. And largely, as a practical matter, it does preclude it.
Representative Parr?
Is that, were you talking about saying that I've heard discussed the front end money?
An FCC ruling that they can't put
it
in the
right
place for
the Court of Appeals sent it back to the FCC to reconsider it. Said that the FCC had looked at certain factors, and then when they reconsidered it, they decided that it was no longer allowable.
Representative Meekins.
Commissioner, I think, I don't know if Joe meant this, but what I got out of what Joe asked and what you said before, you know, right now, because of the cold weather and the gas shortages, there's a lot of talk of, and I don't think they've done it yet, there's a lot of talk of even violating the contracts that are already, you know, that are legally made, and some people have paid premium prices for gas, and their users are being supplied. In other areas, the distributors have not paid those prices, and therefore do not have gas available. But in order for sort of an equity, so everybody has gas, there's a sort of a movement to take it away from where it's already contracted to and distribute it to where it's needed. So, you know, that's just in this situation now, and if we can expect, I think, in years to come, there's still to be those kinds of problems. So I think if you extend that logic out, if they do that, set that precedent, then, as you indicate, it's a very tenuous and insecure situation to say, well, everybody's using our gas, and then we're going to take it back. And regardless of contractual provisions and anything we may think we have legally, I think those might be overridden. And certainly, you know, we try to take our gas back at some future date when it's already sort of committed or at least needed in a certain area. I think it would be, this is a practical matter, it might not apply to
us. I can't resist a really obnoxious pun that the climate for what the state wants to do is very bad.
That won't be the last. Representative Cotton?
Just on that point, I heard on the radio that they are asking the government to declare it a national disaster, and so under that, if he does declare it, then they can jerk it, and I suppose that something like that would have to happen before they could.
Well, I don't think that's a necessary prerequisite, but that's the kind of situation you'd have to be in.
Is it possible, Commissioner, that these companies that are now subject there, have these contracts, the three contracts in question, could, as soon as we approve this contract, turn around and sell that gas to another company? There's no prohibition in the contract. Is there any of them to prohibit that? Is there?
They're explaining that. They're under curtailment, which would act as an effective prohibition against that.
I don't understand.
Under the curtailment is where the pipeline company doesn't have enough gas to meet all the contractual obligations that's already incurred. When you hear that gas is being cut off at factories and people are being laid off, that's a result of curtailment.
Yeah.
And there's a priority category set up by the FTC, which involves essentially four categories.
Well, what?
Okay.
Maybe you're getting to that, but my question really is, what's to prevent them? I mean, the FPC would say they couldn't sell their gas?
If you're a pipeline under curtailment, then you can't sell gas to a new customer until you supplied all your old customers, which means effectively that the gas amount we're selling isn't going to allow anybody to come out of curtailment.
But you're assuming that these companies all have pipelines under curtailment then?
They do.
There's no way that the FPC would approve, or first of all, it would have to approve any sale if they want to make one tomorrow, for example? Mr. Hayes,
are we going to? Are we just asking questions here at random? Or
well,
any particular line? Before he leaves, I want to ask him a question.
Please, if you have questions of Commissioner Martin, ask him now. I wanted to get into some of the technical aspects later, and I didn't want to go too late tonight. But as long as you're satisfied,
go ahead. If you,
why don't you ask your questions?
Before you do it, you may. Well, I want to stay a little bit on the subject that we were just about to tail off on. Question, if I may.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's referring back to quote unquote the front end money, expiration costs, and interest costs, and front end payments are going into the rate base. And that having FPC having seen the list of the work, change their mind. Now, case in point on the Arctic Slope, what is the situation? Put it this way, I'll give you the lead anyway. I can tell you where I've been told wrong. I have been told that there is one because of an indirect one front end payment, if you like, or loan, I guess is a better term, made by Columbia Gas that still is valid. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And that means that Columbia Gas now has the right to 52% of 7/8.
I can't verify that figure, and that sounds much larger than my recollection.
I would say roughly that BP's interest in that utilization would be in the order of 51 or 52% someplace there, and all of BP's Ohio's gas now has it.
I'd have to check that, but that sounds
okay. Well, anyway, that is still legal, whatever amount it is. It survived all this. I'm through with questions on those points. I've got three more on different subjects.
Okay, we'll be shifting here. Representative Pace.
In as much as I think maybe one of the three is going to be what I'm going to ask, I will defer to the chat to ask you three questions.
Okay, I bet you it's not going to be one.
Well, let's.
Okay. Really want to play gods?
Let's not guess. Why don't you just ask your question?
Okay. First of all, I have read the contract, Commissioner Guy, and I've had several other people who've read it, and I'm getting a little bit difference of opinion on this one particular subject, and I'd like your clarification for it. Let's say that we've gotten all through this mishmash procedure, the oil gas pipeline is approved, and these gas sales contracts are approved, and everything else. So let's say it's January 1, 1978, everything's been taken care of, all black and white. Do we have any right under this contract to terminate or to back out of it? Is there any clause in the contract that permits us from then on to the end of 20 years to back out of it and say we don't want to do business with it? Is there any right?
That's one possibility.
I appreciate that. The next question that I have real quickly is that remember, and I couldn't spot it, I ran through here, but there's a little bit of dialogue on whether or not the FPC will include in the rate base the cost of cleaning the gas for transmission. And could you refresh my memory on that? What exposure do we have and under that situation if there is cost that cannot be passed on because the FPC will not include it in the rate base?
If we had not, if it was a cost which we would not have borne had we been taking in value, then our purchasers are obligated to bear that cost, even if the FPC will not allow them to put it in the rate base.
Thank you. Chad, just interrupt for a second. Let me just say that this term was one of probably five or six in the contract that was absolutely the most hotly negotiated.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Right. All right. The last question, and I here again apologize, but it sticks in my mind that some while back, what Statute 3805 used to read as related for the state to bylaw sell any hydrocarbons had to do it by competitive bid. Is that still factual or is that not?
No, sir. The royalty statute specifically provides procedure by selling by negotiation, and quite frankly, when the legislature appropriated $50,000 last year to negotiate, we were pretty sure they meant negotiate.
So we don't have to ever worry about
that. Our interpretation of the word negotiate was negotiate.
Not usual.
Yeah.
So the question about
any questions of Representative Hayes?
Yeah, I'd like to ask we're talking about the subject before us is the contract to sell 1/8 of our oil and gas, and going along with that, we're talking about what's tied in with that is selection of a gas line route, and the public is generally projecting that such and such pipeline route is that could be under construction by 1978, 1989, 1980, whatever, but sometime in the near future. And the thing that I'd like to get clear in my own mind that before I can really get into the, you know, I have to clear that up before I get to the merits of the contract, is has the state determined beyond, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt that it's in the state's best interest to sell our oily gas or allow the other 7/8 to flow south in consideration of the other resources of oil.
You mean as opposed to preventing it from flowing somehow?
Right.
I think the answer to that, and I think later this evening Mr. Gilbert will probably be able to touch on that. Basically, the answer is a combination of things, but our powers to prevent it from flowing are not complete. In fact, maybe saying it the other way, they're limited. The conservation statute, which will certainly be a controlling factor in this situation, it will control possibly and probably over our desire to do other things. It's a fairly definitive statute, and it will be a controlling statute. That would certainly enable us to do that if it's consistent with the purposes of the conservation statute and the way that those statutes have been interpreted by legal cases. Other than that, we effectively have sold the gas pursuant to the leases that we held, and the owners of that gas have certain rights with respect to it, including the right to attempt to build a pipeline to move it. And our rights to negate that contract or say we don't want it moved now are limited by that prior commitment that we made. So to some extent, the state's determination is just limited. And within those constraints, yes, we think that this is the best approach.
I've been under the impression, perhaps erroneously, that the state had absolute power to determine when gas would flow, so that if we needed it as there for reinjection in that field or adjacent fields.
There's really a difference, Representative Hayes, between absolute power to determine it and the second statement you made about reinjecting it in the field, which really alludes to the conservation statute. The statutes that have been upheld in jurisdictions have been upheld for the purpose of achieving the maximum efficient production of a very important resource, oil and gas. And the courts have allowed states to have very important powers over the production of oil and gas, where it can be shown that your public objective is to ensure that you don't waste oil and gas, that you produce it in a way that maximizes the amount you produce. But where it's simply an arbitrary judgment by the state for some other purpose, then the state's powers start being limited fairly drastically, and you run into what we call interstate commerce problems. And so absolute powers are pretty much what you're saying.
Yeah, it probably would not be in a position to determine absolutely for a number of years, is that right?
Well, this is one of the things that Mr. Gilbert's going to talk about, but let me say that the determinations under the conservation statute, which is our greatest extension of power over the rates of production from the field, are based now on modeling, computer modeling, and we believe we will make initial decisions based on that. Will be based subsequently on the early production history of the field, which will give us a better idea, and then it'll be adjusted from time to time during the life of the field as appropriate based on what's happening with the reservoir.
Representative Meekins.
Just on the other side of that, perhaps this is better asked of Mr. Gilbert, but at the same time, to maximize the recovery of the reserve by a reinjection, you sometimes want to reinject the gas in order to maximize efficiency of production. At the same time, is there some sort of limit as to how long you can reinject? Also, is there not?
In some cases, there is. I'll let Ms. Gilbert give more details to this, but I think it's a safe conclusion now that in the case of this field, we've determined that there is no practical limit to how long you can reinject. So, I mean, at least the problem is not that there's some time at which you're doing damage to the reservoir by reinjecting.
In other words, if there is a delay of some sort, what I'm getting at in the building of a gas pipeline, we're not
doing that type of damage, at least.
It's expensive.
That's right.
I have, before Commissioner Martin leaves, I wanted to ask, what in terms of the comparative analysis of the merits of the three routes, would we be safe to assume that the administration is relying on all the information contained in the comparative analysis, I think, of November 76 that was prepared? It was a kind of a summary of November 1976 by the Pipeline Task Force.
I think that's right.
So all the information in that document is let me put it this way. In other words, that contains all the information that you relied upon. That there is no outside.
I'm not sure that's a garden path statement, Clark. I think that's largely true. Fred, do you want to add it?
I think that's a summary of all the information. I mean, we've relied upon all the evidence developed at the FPC, various kinds of assessments, environmental consideration, running the 26 boxes of material stored over at the historical library.
I think you can't. The decision ultimately made by the governor and the recommendation of the task force was a balance of a lot of factors. I'm not sure you can indicate how each individual made his recommendation or so on. You can regard the summary as the total. It's certainly not the total background that everybody had, the governor had, but it's tended to be a summary of that information, and I think it can be relied on for that purpose.
Well, in terms of the finding that the highest net economic benefit to the state was El Paso, is that all the information that we need to consider as far as what on that issue that you know of is contained in that document?
I'm going to defer on the question for this reason, Mr. Chairman. Both Bob Loresa, director of the Division of Policy and Planning, and Ab Gross, who's chairman of the Pipeline Task Force, and Sterling Gallagher are going to be at the hearings on Monday to talk about just that subject. And I'm not certain the answer to that is absolutely yes. Generally speaking, it is yes. But that represents a summary of the information we used.
These gentlemen might supplement that?
I'm sure they'll be able to tell you if there's something that's they'd want to add if they thought was particularly persuasive.
But you don't know of anything beyond that?
No. Okay. And there have been assertions of items that like, for instance, the tanker subsidy idea or something. But in the case of that one, for instance, the decision and the analysis was made absent that. In other words, it wasn't figured in the decision and then left out of the summary. It simply wasn't. It would have been an additional factor that wasn't included. It was sort of a hypothetical. It was a hypothetical additional case that wasn't put in the summary. We thought that, in other words, we concluded that the summary justified the result even without that being included.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to help the Commissioner out for his information. There was an addendum to the November 1976 report. I have it here at hand. I believe it came out quite some time after the decision was made to
I wasn't taking that into consideration at the time, but when I speak of the document, I include that being in it. I think the governor made it clear that our work on the thing is ongoing, and for instance, I think the letter transmittal from Attorney General Gross and both the governor's speech and my statements have made it clear that the way our royalty statute works, you have to make certain decisions are locked in time. One would wonder what would be the political climate in the state if these contracts had not been put before the legislature on the first day, and we were taking the line that you're essentially taking, that we're just not sure, and we just want to keep looking at it for a little while. I suspect that we would be sitting around this table here.
I don't think anyone's taken a position. Yeah. We have a duty to look at the contracts. The appropriation of $50,000 did not require us to approve the contract. It only required, you know, negotiations, and now that
absolutely.
They're here, we look at the results of negotiations.
Absolutely.
I don't think anyone on this committee has taken a position.
I hope I'm not saying that. I don't mean to. What I'm saying is that the way that the royalty statute works, it requires that at a certain point in time, decisions be made, and that then they be advanced through the process so that they can arrive on the legislative doorstep for approval. And it would be obviously desirable for us to be able to continue to remain flexible, but we felt we had to offer the alternative. So it's a way of really addressing that question. As additional information comes along, or for instance, additional actions like the administrative law judge's decision, we're going to consider those things and try to judge our actions pursuant to them.
Representative Barr.
Very simple question. I may know the answer, I'm not sure. Is it correct that the 7/8 of non-royalty gas has not yet been committed, or has it been committed this year?
There were attempts to commit it through advanced sale contracts, which were then negated by the decision that we discussed earlier in the evening. Is there any commitment still outstanding? The one that Chad talked about, but no others.
I thought you said that you simply couldn't pay for it, make them pay for it in advance, but you didn't say you couldn't commit it in advance.
But that was one of the terms of those advanced contracts. So the contracts failed by virtue of that term being included in them.
Is it?
So
yeah.
is it industry against crude oil, which was transferred easy basis to natural gas?
Well, my question simply is right now, though, is it as of now the 7/8, which belongs to the producers, is not committed to any distribution companies like the sort of chemical and southern and so forth, and it's not committed to anybody at this.
With the exception of the Columbia contract that he
yeah. Which is still valid, which is, and that is 50.
We'll check the figure.
Well, that was the BP side, the BP share of the oil, the gas, essentially.
So high. That's always from high.
It's that share, right? That is committed still to Columbia.
Approximately 50% of 70.
Okay, and Columbia gas is clear.
They're all in the Midwest. I think it's a very large one.
So in other words, we'll have
Columbia, El Paso, and Tenneco are always among the top five of the gas companies.
Thank you.
Despite the fact that contracts were negotiated, there still is a statutory requirement, isn't there, that we find that there is a surplus before the sale is made? Is that correct?
Yeah. We attempted to deal with the surplus question. I think we have dealt with it in the terms of the contract. There are two ways to approach it. It would take a long time to talk about the surplus issue. I won't do that here. But
yeah.
One way to do it is to attempt to predict what the surplus would be and then try to mesh what you sell against what you predict and then see if everyone agrees with your prediction. What we've done is simply provided flat out that we have a right to take back whatever we need. So we have essentially a legal surplus. We have a surplus that's protected by the terms of the contract rather than trying to identify it by some quantity.
There are no studies, to your knowledge, that,
yes.
that there are studies?
We are going to be prepared to advance and have advanced in prior hearings before legislative committees our work on surplus of gas. And what it consists of, basically, is projections of various low, medium, and high growth scenarios to indicate what might happen. Because ultimately, all surplus is whatever you believe will happen in the state minus whatever we'll produce. And if you believe we'll build a petrochemical plant, then the surplus is one thing. If you don't, it'll be another.
Is that a completed study or one to be done?
It's completed. It's completed and it'll be ready to be advanced. But it's one that changes constantly, Mr. Chairman, because as you learn more about what the reliability of your predictions are. But it's completed and we'll be prepared to advance.
Is it in a form that
absolutely.
We can
we'll have it. We'll submit it to the committee.
Okay. But I think we'd all like to look at that. Mm-hmm. Representative Chatterton.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Commissioner, on the subject of surplus, I have this question. First, let me read from the transcript of the Advisory Board hearing. It says, it quotes here, at that time we define surplus, the word surplus, or the board did, as the volume of gas available in excess of residential and commercial needs of the state. Now, my question is, when we speak of surplus in the context of our contract here, is it still by that definition?
I'd have to look at the context of the remarks, but I don't think I need to answer your question. In the terms of the contract, we have, if this provision is approved, we have a right to take gas back for any purpose whatever. So the surplus is defined in the broadest conceivable terms. There's only one thing that's not included, and I think I can say this very, very clearly. The only thing that is not an in-state use is liquefaction for export. That's the only thing that's not an in-state use. So liquefaction, even for transporting around the Alaska coast to another community, is in-state use. Anything else is in-state use. So a surplus would only be that which is left over after we call it back. Let me give an example that I gave Representative Meekins the other day in terms of what you can do with this contract. If as you use your example, if everything is locked up and the Trans-Alaska pipeline is approved and every term of this contract is executed and we're in great shape, and that happens in the middle of 1978, and we are expecting that the first gas will flow, let's say, on the first day of 1982, using our two-year notice provision, we can discover that we have a use. Now, we have to have a use. We can't make one up. But if we have a use that would be available for every cubic foot of our royalty gas on the first day that the pipeline would flow, we simply have to give 2 years of notice to the buyers, and they would never take a cubic foot under this contract. So the contract enables us to take every single cubic foot back with that notice, and they'd never take a cubic foot. On the other hand, if we never do develop the in-state uses, then they would be buying a pretty substantial amount of gas simply because we don't really need what we sometimes project to be.
So coming full around, why our election to terminate does have